Welcome to the April episode of Discourse, where we take a religious studies project style look at religion in the news. My name is Theo Wildcroft. Our first guest this time is Jacqueline Hargreaves, the Luminescent and the Hatha Yoga Project. Thank you for joining us. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hello, Theo, and thanks for welcoming me. I research the contemporary meeting place between historical practices, mainly yoga and meditation, and their application in the modern world.
Lovely. And our next guest is Jennifer Uzel from Durham University. So Jenny, again, thank you for joining us. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you research?
Okay. Hi, Thea. Again, thank you for inviting me to take part. I am a PhD researcher with Durham University, with the Centre for Death and Life Studies, and I am researching funeral ritual in contemporary Druidry, specifically around relationships between the dead, the bereaved, and landscape, as it turns out. And I also, in my copious free time, my partner and I own and run a funeral home in Darlington.
Nice. And as I said, my name is Theo Wildcroft. I'm an early career scholar. I've just completed my PhD with the Open University, looking at contemporary yoga culture, particularly significant changes in the nature of authority and governance. So I guess one of the places that the three of us meet is a fascination with lived practice, with bodies, material religion, culture in general. So those are kind of the items we've been focusing on as well, I think. So coming up first, Jenny, you were looking at some really interesting things with regards to religious symbols.
Yes, that's right. And specifically the discourse around the hijab. Following the terrorist attack in New Zealand in March, where the news has been reporting very widely, I think, that the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, was wearing a hijab when she went to speak to the Muslim community after the massacre. And this has been very widely reported in the news. And as a result of that, there has been a lot of things going on in New Zealand with women in prominent positions, news reporters, teachers, just lots of people who are not Muslims wearing the hijab in support, in solidarity with the Muslim community in New Zealand. And this has been very controversial. There's been a lot of support for it. There's also been a lot of uncertainty about it, particularly from some Muslim women who are seeing the hijab as a symbol of oppression and are saying quite widely that they're grateful for the gesture, but they wish that it hadn't been done in this way. Whereas other people, one thing I thought was particularly interesting, some people saying that yes, there is potentially an issue around the hijab is not a straightforward symbol, but at the same time, in this particular context, in this particular place, and under these particular circumstances, where non-Muslim women in New Zealand are specifically wearing hijab in places where people had been afraid to, that is supportive and that is particularly helpful, so that there's a wider dialogue going on than just that around, is this a useful thing to be doing or not? So that was something I found very interesting. And then around that as well, there was a school actually in New Zealand, in Auckland, that had banned Muslim girls from wearing the hijab shortly before this event took place. And obviously there was a bit of an outcry about this, particularly after the media had picked up on women wearing hijab and the school had said that they'd listened to people's responses. And as a result, they were going to allow any girl who wished to wear the hijab on the Friday. That was the day of mourning when a lot of people were doing this. So, but not generally, they hadn't reversed the policy. They were just going to allow all girls to wear the hijab on this occasion. So I thought there were some very interesting things going on around identity and around many, many issues there.
Well, there's something there about the adoption of a religious symbol that isn't actually, that isn't a religion that you personally adhere to, as an act of allyship, of performative kind of allyship with another religion, that I think is really interesting, and what that means is really complicated. So, Jackie, this is kind of your part of the world, really.
It is. I come from Australia, and I do have ancestry to New Zealand. So it was a really shocking event, not only because the perpetrator was an Australian acting in a foreign country, so they were going to he went to New Zealand to perform the atrocity, and the challenge around this this particular subject is an interesting one, because, for example, I did hear some reports of women that chose to wear in solidarity the hijab, and they were saying how it exposed them so much to a sense of vulnerability, that all of a sudden they were becoming aware of how visible it makes them in the community, and also that now that they are a potential victim, basically, because they could be picked out if necessary. So there was some really interesting aspects from each individual that were coming across. Another one was from a newsreader who had chosen to wear the scarf throughout the day when attending events. And then right at the moment of having to present on the news, she had a moment, should she wear it, should she not wear it, should she wear it? And she chose to take it off because she thought, oh, I'm going to public broadcast, and it was an ABC, so an Australian broadcasting channel. She chose to take it off, and then later on in the evening, when she got to watch all of her peers who had chosen to keep wearing the hijab, she felt really disrespectful. She thought, oh, I should have been brave enough to keep it on. So there's some really interesting aspects around identity, as well as the risk associated with wearing a visible symbol of religion, and then what that means in a society where it can bring you harm potentially.
I think it also connects to the very interesting ways in which we kind of negotiate acts of public mourning as well. And I know that this is something that a number of colleagues I know have been working on, that how do you come together in across different faiths and for people who don't have faiths to find ways of collectively marking and mourning these kind of nation, if not international, kind of wide events. And I'm aware of all the different ways that people do that, right the way from people leaving tributes outside places where people have been killed, or different things like that, and the kinds of things people leave and so on. And I think these moments of collectivity are really interesting in terms of how we negotiate the ways in which we do that. I mean, for me personally, for example, I'm always shocked at how much plastic gets left behind at your average kind of public mourning site. People leave a lot of flowers wrapped in kind of a lot of plastic. There's a lot of what I know in some pagan circles is known as ritual litter, which I think is a wonderful term. What do you do? And what do you do with that stuff? What do you do that with that stuff behind? And I'm kind of, I don't know a lot personally about it, but I am also aware of this connection between mourning and modesty, which is there, I think, beyond the kind of the hijab itself, that's also a way in here, that we're used to people kind of covering their heads or uncovering their heads or dressing differently, dressing modestly at occasions of mourning, right? You wouldn't wear your kind of, you're going out Saturday night clothes to a funeral.
Indeed, and I would say that it's only been the last perhaps 50 years that even within Christian societies that people don't wear such things in religious environments.
That's very true.
And one more thing that comes to mind when I think of this particular subject from a Australian and New Zealand perspective was that actually we've had several generations of migrants to Australia identifying as Muslim, and I, from a personal perspective, first generation women often are connecting back to that idea of it being a rebellious act to remove the hijab and to say, I'm going to embrace being free. But then it's often the second generation that choose to take and wear it again as a sign of identity. So there's a really interesting switch that happens between generations around symbols like this.
Yes. Another thing that was really interesting that came out of the comments that I saw on this was one person commenting on it and saying, if you wear hijab, you're identifying with us as Muslims. If you don't wear the hijab, then you're identifying with us as human beings who have been the victim of a tragedy. So what you were saying, Theo, there about appropriating symbols from a religion that you don't personally identify with, there was at least one person there that was taking this two-level thing. You know, is this, how do we relate to this? Who is it that we're identifying with? And also another thing that's happened in the same context, of course, that's also been fairly widely reported, is large numbers of people, very often school children, who have been performing hakas in support and in memory. And again, that's another interesting cultural variation, because a lot of the children that are doing that are not Maori. And yet it's another thing that's been taking up as a form of public mourning. That was a really interesting thing that had happened, I thought.
Indeed, yes. And I'd say that it's that's one aspect of the culture, particularly within New Zealand, where we see a great integration of Indigenous culture with, colonial culture, if you like, in that not only Indigenous languages are starting to be taught, but also things like the haka are taught at school. So people, it's not something that they're appropriating, if you like. It's something that they feel is 100% part of their cultural upbringing.
Well, that brings us really neatly and pleasingly onto the next thing that we wanted to talk about, actually, Jackie. If you want to explain the thing that you noticed in Australia recently.
Okay, so so fitting in with some of my research, which relates to both yoga and mindfulness-based practices. Recently, it was in the Australian news that producers of the very popular mindfulness application, which you can download called Smiling Mind, have teamed up with women in Central Australia, and they are recording meditations in three Indigenous languages. And the main intent is to help combat mental health and trauma issues, which are significant within Aboriginal communities, particularly amongst the young people. In fact, the suicide rates amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are almost double that of the national rate in Australia. And some estimates, particularly for this year and the last, 2018-2019, are suggesting that it's the worst year on record for Indigenous youth suicides. And in fact, this year alone, so 2019, this year alone, there's been 8 Aboriginal children that have taken their lives. 2 of them were 12-year-old girls.
Wow.
So the intent has been to, try to address some of these issues, which, look, it's an ongoing intergenerational trauma which is attempting to be healed, and there's significant amounts of work which needs to be done and isn't currently being funded. But this particular project seems to be addressing a couple of issues, which is to look at not only incorporating Indigenous healers, also providing tools in language, but incorporating it through a Western lens. So they're collaborating with Western health medical professionals. So this does bring up some interesting issues from a mindfulness perspective, particularly when we're looking at the lens of mindfulness being studied. And it often gets called MAC mindfulness now, as it's been appropriated into a therapeutic application, devoid of its Buddhist heritage and perhaps the ethical framework in which it's offered. And so the cultural appropriation debate often clouds some of the application of mindfulness in these types of environments. But it also becomes a sort of like a second layer of challenge is, well, what happens when it's provided to an indigenous community within their language? Does this mean that it is still cultural appropriation, or where does it fit in this particular debate?
It's all really interesting.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk a little bit about that first, and then I'll have another issue that I can bring up.
Well, one of the things that brings it for me is that I'm aware of the work of Willoughby Britton's group on the varieties of contemplative experience. And one of the things that she's saying is if you consider mindfulness and meditation within its Buddhist context, kind of almost hidden within that, or what's often left behind when it gets translated into these kind of secular versions, is an understanding that often there are abreactions to mindfulness techniques, right? That these are, it is possible to have difficult experiences come up as a part of meditation and mindfulness, and often the kind of quick and easy kind of learn mindfulness in a universalized kind of Mac mindfulness way, one of the things it leaves behind is an understanding of when it can go wrong or when it can be tricky and how to deal with those difficult experiences. And I guess I'm wondering how that interfaces with this, because in my experience, the people who are most likely to have issues are those particularly who are suffering from trauma or marginalized groups. So, indeed, I'd be interested to see.
But although I think that in a lot of the what gets bantered about, particularly in the, what would you say, sort of the news and publicity of mindfulness, is this quick and easy lolly sugar type mindfulness, which doesn't have very much depth to the skills involved in negating or navigating difficult emotions or challenging thoughts that arise. However, when it's often framed and taught within particularly systems such as the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy that was developed by the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, the skills around that are certainly geared towards mainly dealing with those types of things. They're the skills that you're attempting to learn. Yeah, it's how do you relate and navigate a world in which these things are naturally arising. So yes, I sort of think that that's an interesting dilemma, because it's a little bit like yoga in a sense that the commodification of the product is one thing, but the application, often if taught by a trained or skillful practitioner, is another.
Yeah. It's kind of two different outcomes, because it's two different depths of training and depth.
Yes, and I don't know. I must say, I haven't. I must say, I haven't had a chance to listen to the meditations themselves. And it says that they do integrate traditional healing wisdom. So this would be an interesting aspect of how does that meld with a worldview that is attempting to incorporate a mindfulness-based application.
And that, I think, would have been my first question. It would have been, how does this idea that's coming out of Buddhism, how does that correlate with the worldview of the sort of Aboriginal worldview? And whether there are any clashes there, and if that's something that has been particularly taken into account, then that's good. The other thing that occurred to me immediately when I saw this was, great as it is, but it seems to me that it's not necessarily addressing the causes for the mental health issues and the difficulties that these people are experiencing. And I did wonder to what extent it sort of cracking over a bigger problem.
Indeed, I think that would be one of the criticisms, but I think at all levels we need to start to address it. It's an enormous issue, and in Australia, and if we don't combat sort of like providing people with immediate skills, we're having you know, to face the rising death toll from suicide, which is, you know, which is not going to face the structural changes that need to occur, perhaps at policy level. So these are sort of two different ways of attacking a similar problem.
I think it. Hopefully, it's symptomatic of a greater policy desire to address these issues that will address the structural stuff as well. Hopefully, it won't just be here's your app and get on with it. You know, but that's always the risk, right? That we kind of individualize the solutions at the expense of the structural solution. But there's not a lot the people designing the apps can do about that. You both know, my area of research is also yoga, but as Jenny knows, I have a great interest also in contemporary paganism, and I'm also fascinated by, I would love to hear these meditations, because I am interested in how we use different cultural resources that may come from very, very different worldviews in order almost to expand the maps of what's possible for us to personally experience. And sometimes they can be slightly shoehorned in, you know, things get cut and chopped, practices get, the roots of practices get cut and chopped in really interesting ways in order to shoehorn them into a very, very different worldview. But I'm interested in how that manages to expand people's experiences that they can achieve as a result, right? If you don't have a cultural resource that's native to you that is about stillness and reflection, for whatever reason, because it's been lost over time or because it was never there, then, you know, sometimes you do need to import these things. But what are you importing alongside? And there's always the relative power of the people doing the importing, the people practicing, who's earning the money, you know, in all of these things. and all of those things are always really interesting, I think. How Buddhist is a mindfulness app that's been secularized to begin with and then translated into indigenous languages and merged with indigenous healing traditions. And I'd be interested to see how ancient those indigenous healing traditions are as well, because
if they're in language, I'm sure that many are, and they do have like a very interesting skill within the Aboriginal community, a particular healing skill called deep listening. And I'm just hopeful that it does incorporate those same skills, because it does require that developing the ability to listen to the inner quiet, or through still awareness, responding to the nature, the environment, and so forth. So these skills are certainly there. They're usually held within the feminine lineage holders. And to hear it in language in which these languages are dying out, I think it's, you know, it's a wonderful trial. Anyway, they've got it on trial in a number of schools, and we'll see,
see where it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is an interesting thing in terms of languages that are endangered as well. I'm aware that there's a film been made recently in the Haida language, which caught my eye because my partner and I visited the Haida Gwaii a number of years ago in Canada. And it's a really interesting way of being part of preserving a language, is to create things in that language. It's really interesting. And that they, everyone who, you know, a number of the incidental actors in the film could speak Haida, but a lot of the main characters learnt the language in order to be in the film, which is kind of really interesting way of doing it. And then it's about, you know, what are the stories you can tell as a result, because the story they were telling was an indigenous folk tale. So that's really interesting as well.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay, so moving on, I thought that a lot of the things in the news recently have been relatively serious when it comes to religion. It seems to be quite a high stakes area of culture, as we know these days. So I had come across something that I thought was slightly hopefully slightly lighter and interesting, which is there's a Polish priest there were photos of him being involved in a rite recently in which objects were being burned, and those objects included an African wooden mask, a Buddhist figure, interestingly, figurines of elephants, which is interesting, books of personality and magic, and Harry Potter. So you've always got to have Harry Potter in there somewhere. What seems to have happened is that there was a service in which participants were invited to bring things that they felt were distracting them or getting in the way of their faith. And the pictures, the images from that have then been slightly retranslated into being a burning of objects connected to the occult, to magic, you know, so that the objects in and of themselves are evil, or somehow wrong and in need of purification. What's interesting about that is that the priest himself has come forward and said that the coverage of this has been unfortunate, which is one of those wonderful words, isn't it? Which is interesting. And I just think it's really, really interesting in terms of our connections to religious objects and to religious materialism, and that which is those objects that are seen to be religious and those objects that are seen to get in the way of our religion. I mean, I guess, you know, it would be similar. I guess people wouldn't have anywhere near as much of a problem if they were burning, say, cigarettes and alcohol and other things that get in the way of, you know, your devotion to the divine, whatever it is. But the fact that these are cultural artifacts that most of us treasure in different ways, and the fact that some of them are things that come from, that are associated with other religions or other cultures, including, you know, African masks and Buddhist figures, I think that's where it gets really interesting in terms of our ideas of purity. And then there's always got to be the interesting footnote is that he got into trouble, I think, most of all locally because an anti-smog group got in touch and he was prosecuted for the illegal burning of waste in an open fire. Interesting. So
obviously there was no value to the smoke in the religious process.
That's what's really interesting in terms of when you're looking at the Hindu rites in particular, involve a lot of burning of things that are very valuable, like in a spiritual sense and in an immaterial sense, is that you burn things and the smoke itself has value, which is kind of the opposite to this, I think. Yeah, I mean, I'm aware that there is all sorts of interesting stuff around fire and religion and ash and religion and so on, and of course ash and smoke and funeral rites, of course, Jenny, which I'm sure is kind of interesting. Yours is you mostly deal with grounds rather than what's it called, crematoria, I believe.
No, we
the other way around.
Quite a lot. We do quite a lot of what I suppose, I hate the term, would be called alternative funerals, but we do very traditional funerals as well. We were involved at one point with the campaign to legalise open air cremation pyres in Britain.
How did that go?
Well. The last legal ones apparently were in the 1920s in Brighton, around the Brighton area, where there was a hospital where a lot of Sikh and Hindu servicemen were being treated after the First World War. Mm. And they did have open pyres there. That's the last time that it was done legally. Now, the result of the campaign is that since 2012, it has technically been legal. But it's functionally illegal in that the rules and regulations around how you're allowed to do it are such that nobody could do it. I do know somebody that is planning to see how far he can push it at some point at a natural burial ground. But and there was, of course, a case up here in near Newcastle a few years ago where a funeral home did have an open air cremation and it was deemed not in the public interest to prosecute. But again, there are issues around that. The gentleman that was cremated was Sikh, but he was homeless, and it was a public funeral in that there were no next of kin. So there is no absolute way of knowing that that is what he would have wanted for himself. And it was, of course, used to make a political point. So there are a lot of issues around that as well, I think. But yes, certainly this idea of cremation and what cremation is doing, and the smoke, certainly I know in Hinduism, and I suspect in early Anglo-Saxon cremations as well, the idea of the smoke going up to the heaven and perhaps reconstituting a new body. So again, the value of the smoke there, very great indeed.
Yes, which is entirely the opposite of what we're talking about here. And I just find that difference really interesting, that a fire actually isn't a great way to get rid of something, because you end up with a lot of stuff.
You know, you get a lot of stuff left behind, yes.
You get ash.
Sometimes the transformation is the thing in question.
Yes, the fact that you do see it's a long, slow process that produces some heat, that stimulates the eyes through a visual sort of, dance. You know, all of that, I think, is part of the ceremony. It's not like you throw something away and then you never see it again. Burning itself is no doubt in some ways quite a cathartic process in this instance anyway.
Well, that's what brings me to my the thing I saw a couple of weeks ago that really fascinated me, which is that because it's only a couple of weeks ago since Ash Wednesday now, and there's a report of a Catholic high school in which people were burned with the ash used for the traditional kind of cross made of ash that's put on the forehead, because it turns out if you burn palm leaves in the wrong way, you get a substance, an ash that's very caustic, and it can actually burn the skin. And that's the interesting thing. The really interesting thing is hidden in some of the reports about this was that the ash had come from a company provided outside Birmingham, which had provided it. So traditionally what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to, I think it's at Easter, you're supposed to keep the palm leaves of
palms,
Palm Sunday,
right?
And you keep them for right the way around
the year.
And then you burn them on Ash Wednesday, and it's that you use for the ash. And so obviously this is not what this school had done. The school had brought ash in from a company, which suggests that there is an entire hidden market out there for ash, for your Ash Wednesday services.
Oh, yes, and many other things as well, I think.
But it's
I can remember being ridiculously surprised when a friend of mine, who at the time was a practicing Catholic, was ordering gluten-free wafers. I don't know why that surprised me, but it did.
Well, you only have to look at India to see what can be done with commodifying religious ritual substances like cow urine and so forth, and ghee, and everything can come bottled, and the wealthier you are, you know, the urine has been collected from a cow that ate a certain amount of organic produce and it never touched the ground and so forth. So this whole process of collection and then how it becomes the
sold on.
I believe there's a temple in India, isn't there, where people donate their hair in completion of vows. And this hair is used to make wigs. And there was an issue at one point because Jewish Orthodox women were using the wigs, and they had an issue over the fact that it was made with hair that had been donated in a Hindu temple.
As part of a Hindu ceremony. There's syncretism right there, right? But, you know, but there's also lots of things around ashram pujas involving various gurus and religious figures. I've, you know, got friends who carry vibhuti ash, you know, the ash that's reported to be from this or that ceremony. And I'm just aware of how much of this comes on trust, really. If you're not doing the burning yourself, if you're not witness to that transformation, then you have to trust that that's where that ash has come from. you have to trust that urine of that particular cow never touched the ground, right? It's
very much so. And I also read, when I was just pre-reading some of the statements around this particular story you brought up, the burning of the ashes, I found that there was a thing called ashes to go, where apparently nowadays in a few countries, including Britain and the US, and you can get your ashes on the run, where the clergy, because it's not a sacrament, are going out into public spaces and giving the ashes to people in public spaces rather than in the church, which is a really interesting brand. Ashes to go.
It's really, really interesting. I guess I'm aware almost of the opposite, which is whenever I've been to kind of events which have culminated in pujas, it's that thing where you've been away for a weekend or for a week or whatever in some kind of new agey Hindu or similar environment, and you always stop off on at the supermarket on the way home to grab something for dinner, and there's always that moment where you have to look at each other and go, am I still wearing the sure that whatever, like, is my hair okay, do I look like a normal human being? Because so often, you know, by the end, it's a event that we go to every year called the Beltane Back Togethering. There's a little plug for people, which is a really fascinating syncretic event in and of itself, run by both kind of South Asian folks and yoga folks and all sorts of things, lots and lots of bhakti yoga and lots of puja. By the end of that, you've had so many different substances kind of anointed, poured on you, kind of thrown at you, and glitter in the hair and goodness knows what else besides. You're just kind of used to wandering around like that with all the other devotees, but when you go out of that environment, and it is very much a brand of, here's the weird hippies, and I do wonder what the locals think about the occasional influx of people with weird ash on their heads, and how do you tell?
It's a religious identifier.
Of course, you can tell the Catholics from the Hindus, because the Catholics have a cross and the Hindus just have a dot, I guess. So that's how you figure it out, I guess. We're back around to religious symbols again, aren't we?
Indeed, yes.
Whether that would get all of us fired in Quebec if we wandered around with ash on our foreheads. it's nice to finish with something a little lighter, although of course I'm sure for the people who were burned, it was a nasty experience, but still interesting to think about the everydayness and the materiality of religion. Again, I'm struck again by the different stories that you're able to tell, or the different things you're able to find out about religion by focusing on the details and the material things, and the kind of the things you might not think of immediately, like where does the ash come from? Certainly from now on, I'll be interested to know where things like that come from in ceremonies. Kind of fascinated to find out. Really.
I have a story for Jennifer, which I can tell her because she's so interested in funeral rites. And it happened to be the very first day I arrived in Japan. I was attending a cremation for my friend's grandmother, and because we were representing his side of the family, we got invited to the ceremony of cremating the body and then attending the service afterwards. And I was completely shocked that the part of the process at the end was, you know, the very intimate family was to see the bodies that came out of cremation, and you were given these extra large chopsticks, so not the normal ones, right? I was only first day in Japan, but there were these enormous chopsticks, and I had to pick a bone to place in the little collection.
In the urn?
That was going to be taken home, you know. That was like part of the process was to choose a bone. And then the person who is sort of doing the ceremony, they will tell you the significance of that bone. But I was so scared because my hands were shaking and I had these enormous sort of really big oversized chopsticks. I thought I was going to, you know, just sort of mess up this whole body that had somewhat turned to ash, but there were still quite large pieces of bone visible.
And that is something I think that we, because of how we are presented cremated remains in the West, usually, not always, but usually, they've been through a cremulator at the crematorium. So what we get is very finely ground powder that in no way resembles a person. Mm. And it's part of this sanitization of death that we, I think, have become really good at in this country. Mm. And I have seen cremated remains that come out of the cremator before they go through that process. And it's a very, very different thing. Mm. And I was actually reading a paper yesterday about Anglo-Saxon cremation and what you can, to some extent, work back about possible beliefs. And again, what you had was a cremated skeleton that was, and most of the pieces of bone quite large that go into cremation urns, and pieces on the skull that are usually laid on top. So there is some thought given to the positioning of the body within the cremation urn. It's not just that everything is picked up and put in. And there was a suggestion that it was a reconstitution of the body within the cremation urn, which was very interesting.
Wow. Yes, interesting stuff. Well, on that note, I'm sure we could talk much longer. Let's hope that by the next episode of Discourse we don't have any large terrorist tragedies to talk about. That would be lovely to go a month without that really in the world. But mostly I just want to thank you both for joining me today, and I hope we can do this again sometime. Presumably neither of you have any last things to say.
No, thank you very much, Theo, and thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah, it was lovely to meet you, Jackie, and very interesting stuff. Thanks.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I hope our listeners enjoyed this episode of Discourse and hanging out with us with a little bit of a religious studies reflection on the news. I hope we gave you a few things to be thoughtful about, and Discourse will be back in a month or so. Join us then. Thank you.
The RSP is sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, and the International Association for the History of Religions. The Religious Studies Project is produced by the Religious Studies Project Association, SCIO, a Scottish charitable incorporated organisation, charity number SC047750. Brought to you by founders and editors-in-chief Chris Cotter and David Robertson, and managing editor Thomas J. Coleman III. Our features are edited by Marek Sullivan and Rebecca Barrett-Fox, and our Opportunities Digest by Ella Bock. Podcast transcription by Helen Bradstock, with audio editing by Gregory Schneider and Samuel Ward. Social media managed by Ray Radford, sales and marketing by Sammy Bishop, and video editing by Jonathan Tuckett. Don't forget, you can support the project by using our amazon.com.co.uk and .ca links, or donating at patreon.com/projectrs, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, iTunes, and other portals.